Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 3rd, 2022, Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Investigators Focus on Single Neighborhood by Shelley Bradbury. Denver Doubles Rates at Meters by Joe Rubino. Cases Up 4,600% in Puerto Rico by Francis Robles of the New York Times. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Investigators Focus on Single Neighborhood. Sheriff says fire originated in area off Colorado 93 in Marshall Road by Shelley Bradbury. Investigators narrowed the point of origin of the most destructive wildfire in state history to a neighborhood off Colorado 93 in Marshall Road, near where a passerby captured video of a burning shed the morning the fire started, Boulder County Sheriff Joe Pell said Sunday. The fire originated somewhere in that neighborhood, he said during a news briefing on Marshall fire recovery efforts. There was a viral video that was posted of a shed on fire. We don't know that that shed started the fire or whether it was secondary. Pell emphasized that investigators are still working to find the exact origin and cause of the wildfire, which on the back of hurricane-force winds burned across 6,219 acres Thursday, destroying or damaging more than 1,000 homes and businesses in Superior, Louisville, and unincorporated Boulder County. Two people remain missing and feared dead. The sheriff refused to speculate on the fire's cause several times during the briefing. It's complicated and it's under snow, Pell said. We will sort it out. It's an active open deal and the outcome of that investigation is vital. There is so much at stake, so we are going to be careful. A man who lives near the intersection where the Marshall fire is believed to have ignited, Mike Zoltowski, said Sunday he believes he witnessed the start of the wildfire on the property next door to him, a pack of houses and land occupied by members of the 12 tribes, a Christian religious sect. Zoltowski looked out his window at about 11:30 a.m. Thursday to see a fire truck making a beeline for the neighboring property, he said. Smoke billowed from the property and knock-you-over winds blasted Zoltowski when he stepped outside to investigate. Members of the controversial sect, founded in the 1970s in Chattanooga, Tennessee, lived in several buildings around 5325 Eldora Springs Drive in Boulder County, Zoltowski said. That address is listed as the location of the 12 Tribes community in Boulder on the group's website. The Eldorado Springs Drive compound is one of many communities and businesses affiliated with the 12 Tribes across the world, including the Yellow Deli in Boulder and another community in Manitou Springs. 12 Tribes previously has been investigated for child labor law violations in New York, and in 2019, a former sect member told the CU Independent, the University of Colorado Boulder's student news publication, that he was beaten as a child when he belonged to the group. It's really obvious where that fire started. Zoltowski, who works with a company that builds fire-resistant homes, has lived next door to that property for about a month in a home owned by his friend Dave Maggio. When Zoltowski stepped out to investigate the fire Thursday morning, he approached the homes on the sect's property and found three people huddled between two cars trying to shelter from the brutal wind. Two younger guys crouched with an older man, Zoltowski said. They were like, he broke his shoulder, Zoltowski said of the older man, and I was like, oh man, what the hell is going on over there? And they said one of our dwellings caught on fire. What was weird is they were like, it's okay. It was a weird interaction. Zoltowski helped the two younger men get the older man inside in a house on the compound. Then I went over to their field, and their field was on fire, he said. The strong winds pushed him over as he walked back to his house. At one point, he looked up to see a line of women and children moving from one building on the compound to another, holding hands. He's sure now, thinking back, that the wildfire began on the 12 tribes' property. I don't want to speculate. It's still under investigation, but there is no possible way the fire started from any other place, he said. Pell cautioned Sunday that the investigation into the fire's start hasn't yet pinpointed the cause or exact location, but he said it was clear that the blaze began in that general area. Well, it's pretty obvious when you drive through or see the video posted online, he said. I was here this morning. I am not a trained fire investigator, and it's really obvious where that fire started and what direction it went. Pell said investigators have spoken to witnesses but declined to say if all those involved are cooperating with the investigation. I'm not going to get into that, he told reporters. Since the fire, members of law enforcement have been in and around the Sex property every day, Zoltowski said. Sheriff's officials on Saturday confirmed they served a search warrant on a property in connection with the Marshall Fire investigation, but Pell has repeatedly refused to identify the location. On Sunday, authorities could be seen fencing off the 12 tribes' buildings, Zoltowski said. Governor Jared Polis said Sunday that investigators will look to hold someone responsible for the blaze if it was caused by deliberate or reckless burning. If there was any form of deliberate or accidental arson, I fully expect any of those responsible will be held fully responsible under the law for the utter devastation that was caused, he said. A member of 12 Tribes, who identified himself only as Lee in a phone call with the Denver Post on Sunday, denied that the fire started on the Sexton's Boulder property, but he also said he was based in New Hampshire and was hearing information secondhand. A person who answered the phone at Boulder's Yellow Deli directed questions to the sheriff's office and then hung up Sunday morning. They definitely had fires. The home Zoltowski lives in on El Dorado Springs Drive, belongs to Maggio, who in September moved to a new house a few miles away on Panorama Drive. Maggio, who lived beside the religious sect for about 5 years, said fires were a regular occurrence on the compound and firefighters had been called to the several-acre property before. They definitely had fires that got out of control where authorities were called back in that same field where the shed was, he said. Pell declined to say Sunday whether authorities had previously responded to illegal burning in the area where the fire began. There are trails, businesses, houses, and a mobile home park in the area. Investigators initially believed downed power lines may have started the fire, but have since ruled that out. Officials have said telecommunication cables did come down in that area during Thursday's 100-mile-per-hour windstorm and could have been mistaken by passersby as electrical lines. A reporter who visited the area where the blaze began saw overhead lines dangling. Maggio said his neighbors generally kept to themselves, and he never saw problems that prompted him to call the police while he lived beside 12 tribes. When Zoltowski called Maggio to tell him about the fire on Thursday, Maggio was worried about his old home right beside the blaze. He was not concerned for his new house several miles away on Panorama Drive. But not long after Zoltowski alerted him to the fire, Maggio received a reverse 911 call to evacuate his Panorama house. He got everyone out, pets and kids, and the new house burned to the ground. The home on El Dorado Springs Drive was untouched. Denver doubles rates at meters. Increase expected to bring $9.5 million for bike infrastructure, sidewalk repair, transit projects, by Joe Rubino. Parking availability has been a thorn in Lori Helmick's side for the 23 years she has owned Lux Salon in the 1700 block of Wazee Street in lower downtown Denver. She remembers writing letters to the city, lobbying against it when meter rates were increased from $1 an hour to $1.50 an hour in 2002. Then Lodo Brewery owner and soon-to-be mayor John Hickenlooper campaigned on bringing the rates back down and made good on that promise in 2003. Meters in the city have cost a buck an hour ever since. For Helmick and people looking to park at meters the city over, 2022 represents a new escalation in the battle to park cheaply on city streets. Starting on Monday, meter rates in Denver will double to $2 per hour, according to officials in the city's Department of Infrastructure and Transportation. I read that someone with the city said they thought the timing was right, Helmick said of the impending rate increase. I wanted to punch my computer. The increase is expected to push meter revenue up to close to $19 million next year, a record amount that will supply an estimated $9.5 million in new money for bike infrastructure, sidewalk repair, and transit projects. Officials are not anticipating more tickets on windshields as a result of the change, at least not right away. Our goal is to focus more on getting the word out and educating drivers, especially during the early weeks as this change takes effect, DOTI spokeswoman Vanessa Lacayo said in an email. We'll plan to have our standard enforcement team out. Helmick isn't the only person upset over the new pricing. The timing of it, with consumers dealing with supply chain-driven inflation and businesses still struggling to recover from hits taken earlier in the pandemic, has some in Denver wondering, why now? Madeline Hubler didn't have to feed the meter when she pulled up outside restaurant O City on East 13th Avenue last month. It was after 6 p.m., the time at which meters in the Capitol Hill neighborhood go dark for the night. Hubler said she hadn't heard of the impending rate increase. It's not surprising, but still frustrating for the 23-year-old. I guess it's not that expensive, she said, of the $2 rate, but that along with everything else in the city is getting more expensive. In lower downtown, Jared Parrott is worried about how the change will impact his business, 5280 Custom Framing, near the corner of 15th and Wazee Streets. Street parking is all he has to offer, and sometimes consultations for custom work can take hours. Quite frankly, the timing couldn't be any worse, in my opinion, Parrott said. I don't think it's the way to encourage people to come downtown when you're already having trouble getting people to come downtown. But in the eyes of city officials and public transportation advocates, the increase is long overdue. Lacayo, in an email, said the new increase will better align our rates with our peer cities and the rates for private on- and off-street parking, which doubled since the early 2000s. In Austin, Texas, a city Denver has often compared to as a growing tech hub before the pandemic, street parking rates are $2 per hour for the first 2 hours and then go up after that, according to the city's website. Salt Lake City charges $2.25 per hour with a maximum time limit of 2 hours, the same limit as at most meters in Denver for parking in its downtown area. Even Colorado Springs and Boulder's city parking spots cost more than $1 an hour. Streets are public spaces. Everybody should have access to that space and feel safe and comfortable in that space, said Jill LeContour, executive director of the Denver Streets Partnership, a coalition of groups focused on making Denver less car-dependent and its transportation network safer for pedestrians, cyclists, and others. Increasing the parking meter rates is applying a more rational value to this scarce and valuable resource in the city of Denver, she added. LeContour emphasized a growing number of research demonstrates that when cities and things such as bike lanes and do away with parking spaces, sales at local retailers tend to increase. How will additional parking meter money be spent? How the expected $9.5 million in extra parking money will be spent next year comes to 40% to transit projects, 20% for new bike infrastructure, 20% for sidewalk build-out and repair, and 20% to safety projects, DOTI's Lacayo said. Meter money has already come up as a possible source of funding to help replace thousands of speed limit signs around Denver. The city council voted in December to reduce the limit on most neighborhood streets to 20 miles per hour from 25 miles per hour. The speed limit reduction and the meter increase are viewed as building blocks in Mayor Michael Hancock's Vision Zero initiative, which seeks to eliminate traffic-related deaths on city streets by 2030. More investment in transit options doesn't mean much to Helmick. For years, the salon owner has focused on encouraging clients to take light rail when coming in for an appointment. Recent publicity around drug activity and other public safety concerns at Union Station has now made that a non-starter for many, she said. And more expensive parking doesn't just impact clients, but also salon staff who have to find a place to keep their cars for shifts that sometimes last well beyond 8 hours. The redevelopment of former surface parking lots into new buildings, like the nearby McGregor Square project across from Curl's Field, has made the search for day-long options even more difficult, she said. We have just seen the brunt of the parking challenges. I am really worried about losing regulars and new clients, Helmick said. I am not feeling optimistic about the future at all from a business perspective. Dacry Davis, 50, lives in Montbello, but says she goes downtown a couple of times a week, mostly for entertainment. She recently parked at a metered spot on Bannock Street before walking over to the Chris Kindle Market in Civic Center Park. I think it's ridiculous, David said of the rate increase. I think, for the most part, when people come downtown, they spend their money on food, beverages. They shouldn't have to spend it on parking. The increase could change Davis's approach to downtown visits, she said. She may favor Sundays in the future when parking is free. More Lyft and Uber rides are also likely in her future. And ultimately, I may not come down as often either, she said. Cases up 4,600% in Puerto Rico by Francis Robles of the New York Times Company. Armed with her vaccine passport and giddy urge to celebrate the holiday season, Laura Delgado and 60,000 other people in Puerto Rico attended a Bad Bunny concert 3 weeks ago. 3 days later, she was sick with COVID-19, one of about 2,000 people who are believed to have fallen ill as a result of the two-day event. We did so well, we followed the rules, said Delgado, a 53-year-old interior designer. We followed the mask mandate, our vaccination rate was so high that we let our guard down. The second Christmas came, we were like, we're going to party. The Super Spreader concert helped usher in an explosion of COVID-19 cases in Puerto Rico, which until then had been celebrating one of the most successful vaccination campaigns in the United States. The concert was one of a series of business events, company holiday parties, and family gatherings that fueled a 4,600% increase in cases on the island, a surge that public health officials worry could linger into the new year. The Puerto Rican holiday season stretches to Three Kings Day on Thursday. While the Omicron variant has besieged the entire country, it is especially worrisome in Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory already overwhelmed by government bankruptcy, an exodus of health professionals, and a fragile health care system. Officials imposed a new wave of tough restrictions on travelers off the new wave of cases. Rafael Irizarry, a Harvard University statistician who keeps a dashboard of Puerto Rico COVID-19 data, posted the daunting facts on Twitter. One-third of all coronavirus cases the island has recorded since the start of the pandemic occurred in the past month. The number of cases per 100,000 residents jumped to 225 from 3 in 3 weeks. In December, the number of hospitalizations doubled, twice. Without the polarizing politics that have plagued the debate over vaccines in other parts of the country, nearly 85% of those in Puerto Rico have received at least one vaccine dose, and about 75% have gotten both shots. But in the face of a highly contagious new variant, a high vaccination rate is not that meaningful anymore, Irizarry said. Most in Puerto Rico have passed the six-month limit beyond which the vaccine's effectiveness begins to wane, yet at least 40% have yet to receive their booster shots, health officials said. At one point last week, the daily case count had surpassed 11,000, a high figure for an island with just 3.2 million inhabitants. The exponential increases have begun to taper off, but case numbers are still climbing, Irizarry said. I first noticed something going on December 13th, and I alerted the Department of Health, he said. By the 14th and 15th, it was obvious. I called the guy who runs the database and said, is there some kind of glitch in the database? There are currently 317 people hospitalized with COVID-19, more than a quarter of whom are children, according to the island's Department of Health. That's about half the number of people who are hospitalized with the illness at this time last year, before so many people were vaccinated. But it is still proving to be a challenge for hospitals. The problem is, let's suppose Omicron is half as bad, Irizarry said. If you have eight times more cases, the math doesn't work out in your favor. Governor Pedro R. Pierluisi has ordered lower capacity limits in restaurants. To attend large public events, people now have to be vaccinated and present a negative COVID-19 test. Passengers arriving on domestic flights must show a negative test taken within 48 hours before arrival, regardless of their vaccination status. Similar rules were already in place for international flights. Mass public events, including an important celebration to commemorate the 500th anniversary of the island's capital, San Juan, have been canceled. Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve, which ABC had planned to broadcast live from Puerto Rico in front of big crowds, was downgraded to a virtual event. After a few dozen Miss World contestants got sick, the pageant finals in Puerto Rico were canceled. On Thursday, the Scientific Coalition, a group of scientists and health professionals that has been advising the governor, recommended even stricter measures, such as limits on alcohol sales and shorter hours for bars and other establishments. On Friday, the governor followed the recommendation and ordered businesses closed between midnight and 5 a.m. from Tuesday until January 18th. He also mandated booster shots for restaurant employees and public safety workers. It's a message that's hard to digest when 2 weeks ago the case numbers here were among the lowest in the world, said Daniel Colon Ramos, a Yale University professor who is president of the coalition. The measures are particularly hard in Puerto Rico, he said, where it is hard to overstate the importance of a holiday season that starts at Thanksgiving and lasts until Thursday. He described it as 4th of July plus the Super Bowl. Christmas is a week that Puerto Ricans celebrate their identity, he said. They celebrate their family, they celebrate their faith, they celebrate their heritage. The average age of people who become infected on the island is 33, health officials said. But experts worry that if young people who become infected while attending parties and other events visit elders for New Year's and Three Kings Day, the number of sick older people is certain to rise. With so many of its young professionals moving in recent years to Florida, Texas, and other states, Puerto Rico has a disproportionately high percentage of older adults, many of whom suffer from diabetes, obesity, and other ailments that put them at higher risk for coronavirus complications. We have a health system that is, it's not a secret, fragile, said Carlos Meado Lopez, the island's Secretary of Health. He urged people not to unnecessarily overwhelm testing centers and insisted that Puerto Rico had the tools necessary, such as monoclonal antibody treatments, to combat the crisis. But experts also caution that thousands of medical professionals have left Puerto Rico in recent years in search of higher salaries, which could complicate the island's ability to attend to large numbers of sick people. The number of doctors on the island has dropped by 5,000 since 2006, and another exodus of primary care doctors is anticipated because they were left out of recent tax incentives designed to keep specialists from leaving, said Victor M. Ramos Otero, president of the Puerto Rico Doctors Association. The problem we have is not the beds, Ramos said. The principal issue is the personnel. Building community via ladder trucks and takedowns. Firefighters John Alley and Luke Barron also coach Columbine's wrestling team. From the series Faces of the Front Range by Kyle Newman. For John Alley and Luke Barron, being firefighters and varsity wrestling coaches isn't simply a matter of balancing two jobs. It's more like a double dip in intertwined vocations. Alley is an engineer for the Westminster Fire Department, while Barron is a firefighter for the Denver Fire Department. They've coached at Columbine High School together for 6 years, the past two as co-head coaches. The sum of both jobs requires early mornings and late nights, traded shifts at the station, and aching muscles from drilling with the rebels in the wrestling room. But the payoff, building community via fire trucks and takedowns, makes it all worthwhile. On the job, most times we see people at their bad moments, and they're going through their worst time right now, and that's why we're there, Barron explained. I like knowing when we show up at the bad stuff, we're giving someone a chance to get things back to how they should be, and it's kind of a similar outlook in the room. It's all about helping a kid figure out how to grind through something hard. Think about how many doors that opens for young men in the future. Alley got his career start with Vail Fire and Emergency Services, and Barron with the Breckenridge Fire Department. But the Heritage High School graduates both eventually returned to the metro area, where Barron's been with Denver since 2006, and Alley with Westminster since 2015. Both men embody the traits one might expect from a character sketch of a coach firefighter, speaking softly but carrying a big axe, and consistent humility contrasting the can-do intensity that's required by being around the mat or arriving on scene at an emergency. The 5'8" Alley, 34, has an athletic build and wears rectangular glasses that underscore the intellectual approach he has to both jobs. How Alley does one thing, he does everything. He takes as much pride in driving the rig on precise routes as he does in toughening up his wrestlers. He's a member of the Wildland team, which is deployed regionally and nationally to aid in forest fires, and a few years ago received an award for helping save a man's life on a medical call. He takes a studious approach to engineering, noting he's got room for growth in knowing the best routes in the city, knowing the rigs, knowing how to troubleshoot mechanical tools and parts of the apparatus. And he, like Barron, embraces his role as a member in the room, as a mentor in the room. My motivation, coaching-wise, is showing these kids that they're capable of so much more than they think they're capable of, Alley said. Every once in a while, you see them have these aha moments, and that's what you're most proud of as a coach. You see their struggles on the mat, and when they succeed, you know the hard work they put in to get there. The 6'1" Barron, 42, carries a heavyweight frame and has rocked a Fu Manchu mustache for decades. He's verbally understated. Everything you need to know about him comes not from his mouth, but from the mundane details of his job and the moments when no one is looking. Barron is the one to pick his wrestlers up after a tough night on the mat. He relishes the time spent with his 6-year-old son, a budding wrestler himself, and his infant daughter. They are his first post-dual chit-chats. And you'll never catch Barron bragging on his 16 years of service with Denver Fire, where he says every day is the fulfillment of a childhood dream. As a kid, you look and see the fire trucks going down the street and you think, they're probably going to help someone, and man, that truck is just cool, Barron said. Now when a kid lights up seeing my truck, I light up. What's important to me is I just put my gear on the rig and go to work with when the bell sounds. While Alley and Barron remain reserved about their community impact, they are quick to acknowledge the influence of their wrestling Sherpa. Ray Barron, Luke's father, was a longtime Colorado prep wrestling coach and member of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. He was Columbine's coach from 2017 to 20 and passed away in October 2020 from brain cancer at age 70. Both Alley and Barron wrestled for Ray at Heritage and coached under him as assistants at Columbine. Ray's death presented personal and professional adversity for both men. How could and should they go on? with their guiding light in the sport extinguished. But go on, they did. Over the past 2 years, Allie and Barron guided two Columbine wrestlers, Jack Forbes and Zach Schrader, to consecutive Class 5A state titles, while also carrying on the Beyond the Mat legacy Ray left behind. To emphasize that legacy and the scholarship fund now behind it, the Columbine Wrestling Room got a facelift ahead of this season with Ray's mantra, strength and honor, emblazoned on the wall pads. They took Ray's passing as a challenge. That coach left the entire program to them, and it's awesome to see what they've done with it, said junior Will Schrader, one of Columbine's standouts and the younger brother of Zach. Last year, with my brother and Jack winning state again, Allie and Barron were there all the way. They were the ones sitting in those corners. They took the responsibility of the program and are determined to grow it. There's no doubt they've done that, and there's no doubt why they do it. They love everyone in the Columbine room. They give everyone they have, everything they have to us and this school and community. Coach Ray Barron would be proud. I know I am, and I'm grateful too. Sargent helps train others in lethality assessment tool by Mitch Byers of the Daily Camera. A University of Colorado Boulder sergeant is leading the way in using an assessment tool used to determine the level of danger a victim of domestic violence is in, and officials are hoping the tool will soon be used countywide. The lethality assessment program was pioneered by the Maryland Network Against Domestic Violence based on research into characteristics of domestic violence cases that resulted in women's deaths or near deaths. The assessment tool was being used in Douglas County, so when Doreen Jockhurst moved from Parker to become the chief of police at CU Boulder, she asked CU Sergeant Eric Edford to look at bringing the tool to Boulder. The reason we like this assessment tool is the scientific research that had gone into backing it, said Edford, who is in the department's investigations unit. That's why we were really drawn to it. The assessment tool consists of 11 questions. An officer responding to the scene of a domestic violence call that determines the case meets the criteria based on the answers will automatically follow a set protocol that puts the victim in touch with domestic violence resources. That way, we can help them be safe and provide that ongoing support, Edward said. The ideal goal is saving lives and keeping things from recurring, but also providing them tools. The protocol is automatically triggered if the victim answers yes to any of the following three questions. Has he or she ever used a weapon against you or threatened you with a weapon? Has he or she threatened to kill you or your children? Do you think he or she might try to kill you? The protocol is also triggered if the victim answers yes to four of the following eight questions. Does he or she have a gun, or can he or she get one easily? Has he or she ever tried to choke you? Is he or she violently or constantly jealous, or does he or she control most of your daily activities? Have you left him or her or separated after living together or being married? Is he or she unemployed? Has he or she ever tried to kill himself or herself? Do you have a child that he or she knows is not his or hers? Does he or she follow or spy on you or leave threatening messages? Boulder County Deputy District Attorney Ann Kelly, who heads up the office's recently created domestic violence response team, said she believes this assessment tool is effective because it takes into account the victim's knowledge and the entire history of the relationship in ways that assessments that rely on criminal histories or facts of the current case do not. What I like about this assessment tool is the information about risk is coming from the victim, Kelly said. The victim is the most reliable and effective predictor of risk. As an example, Kelly noted the question, do you think he or she might try to kill you? That can't be answered by data or history, Kelly said. That can only be answered by that victim. But while a lot of research and study went into examining the risk factors, Edford noted that actually using the assessment is a matter of simple yes or no questions and easy for officers on scene. That's the nice thing. The questions themselves are pretty self-explanatory, Edward said. Edward has been leading the effort to train more officers to use the tool so all Boulder County agencies can use it. He has been just amazing in his courage and leadership, Kelly said of Edward. If all of our agencies are utilizing this tool, we can incorporate that into bond arguments. I'm hoping that would be another tool to present to our judges. Boulder District Attorney Michael Doherty said assessing domestic violence cases is important, given the danger of those defendants reoffending. It's about us in the criminal justice system doing a better job identifying where the greatest risk lies and us having a better response, Doherty said. Edward said domestic violence calls are not just dangerous for victims, but also for offenders and officers. Edward's work was honored at a ceremony for Boulder County domestic violence advocates named after Beth Haynes, a Boulder police officer killed while responding to a domestic violence call. These are volatile types of crimes and volatile types of situations, Edward said. It's deadly for law enforcement walking in and deadly for victims and sometimes perpetrators. With that in mind, Edward said he has had discussion with the Colorado District Attorney's Council about spreading this assessment tool not just across Boulder County, but across the state. That would be the goal, be it this tool or another, to have some of these tools and some of these questions pushed to the field, push out to the officers so they can help save lives, Edward said. Two dead, two wounded in shooting in Denver. Denver police were investigating an early Saturday morning shooting that left two people dead and two others injured. The shooting occurred in the 1900 block of Blake Street, according to a 1:54 a.m. tweet from the police department. Four people were shot. The deceased individuals were a male and a female, police said, and two males sustained gunshot wounds and were transported to a local hospital. Identities for the deceased were not available, and the investigation is ongoing, according to a public information officer. Police on Twitter asked that anyone with information to call Crime Stoppers at 720-913-STOP or 7867. Police trio arrested in woman's death and kidnapping. Three people from Wyoming were arrested as suspects in connection to the kidnapping and death of a woman whose body was found Friday in Douglas County. On December 16th, Aurora police were contacted by Fort Collins police about a missing person investigation, according to a news release. Investigators determined that the 29-year-old victim was last seen on November 6th when she was allegedly kidnapped in the area of East Colfax Avenue and Victor Street. The victim's body was found near Colorado 83 and Russellville Road in Douglas County near Franktown, police said. A 2016 Chevrolet Malibu associated with the suspects was seen in the area where the body was found on November 7th. The vehicle has been seized. The suspects, two men and a woman, were arrested in Sheridan, Wyoming on Wednesday on unrelated charges, police said. Aurora detective interviewed the trio and arrest warrants for first-degree kidnapping were secured. The suspects are being held at the Sheridan County Detention Center. The victim was apparently killed by a gunshot wound, according to police. Investigators identified the suspects as Chantel Edlund, 43, of Sheridan, Casey Childers, 39, of Casper, and Leo Van Buskirk, 23, of Sheridan. Police said they expected first-degree murder charges will be filed in the case. And now to sports. Lost in L.A., blowout loss clinches Broncos' fifth consecutive losing season. Defeat ensures sixth straight year without a trip to the playoffs. Analysis by Ryan O'Halloran. Desperate times call for an unorthodox measure when the Broncos faced fourth down from the Los Angeles Chargers one-yard line on Sunday. Minus key players up and down their depth chart and trailing by 10 points, offensive coordinator Pat Shurmur called a gadget play. Tailbacks Mike Boone and Melvin Gordon flanked quarterback Drew Locke in the shotgun. Boone received the handoff and flipped it back to receiver, former college quarterback Kendall Hinton, as Locke ran to the right flat. But safety Nasir Adderley blitzed unblocked and was immediately in Hinton's face, forcing him to flutter a pass to Locke, who was unable to cross the goal line. "It was there. It was open," tight end Noah Fant said. "It was a well-designed play." Such is the Broncos' 2021 fate. Even the best-designed plays fail. On a must-get-points possession, the Broncos got nothing. A turning point in a 34-13 loss to the Chargers at Stan Kroenke's Los Angeles Palace. A game of nothing. The Broncos never led and trailed for the final 56 minutes, 49 seconds, in a season of nothing. No playoffs and no winning record. Early afternoon losses by Baltimore and Miami kept Denver's slim postseason hopes alive, but the scoreboard confirmed the disparity in available players between the Broncos, who are 7-9, and Chargers, who are 9-7. And so, with one game remaining, will it be the last for Coach Vic Fangio? The Broncos know they will be watching the playoffs. Again. The six-year playoff drought is the second longest in franchise history, behind only the bad old days of the team's existence from 1960 to 76. The loss also clinched the Broncos' fifth consecutive losing season, also the second longest in team history, 10 years from 1963 to 72. "It stinks," safety Justin Simmons said. "It's tough. You put in so much work and go out there and have that type of performance all around. I don't know if I can even put a word on it for how guys are feeling." The focus now turns squarely to general manager George Patton, who, if he looks at Fangio's entire three-year body of work and not just the last 11 months, he observed in person since replacing John Elway, some of the data is damning. Through two offensive coordinators and 3 weeks, starting quarterbacks, Fangio could never find the right answers. The Broncos have failed to score more than 20 points in 29 of his 48 games and are 6-23 in those games. As this season crumbled, they scored 9, 10, 13, and 13 points in their last four losses. Just as concerning is how Fangio and his staff were unable to stem the proverbial losing tide. The Broncos have 5 losing streaks of at least 3 games since the start of 2019. For context, Mike Shanahan had only 7 in his 14 years. The Broncos started 0-4 in 19, 0-3 in 20, and are now limping to the finish line. "Very disappointing," Fangio said simply. Fangio should be proactive this week at the Broncos facility, delegate some of the game planning for Kansas City to his staff, and start grinding away on a plan to keep his job, one he can present to Patton well ahead of the traditional day after the season axe falling. Have a plan for staff changes on offense, defense, and special teams, and present a list of names he can pursue to call plays or coach up position groups. Be honest about his shortcomings in game clock timeout management, and promise to be more team-wide hands-on instead of waiting for things to unravel to get involved, like after the Week 7 loss at Cleveland. If this season ends with a 4-game losing streak, it becomes hard to justify progress was made. "We started off 3-0, and we should have been 3-0, Fant said. "We had a better team than the teams we were playing. We went against some tougher teams, and we got some and lost some. The biggest thing is, you get into some of these tight games, we have to pull those out. It feels like we haven't answered the bell in that aspect this year. That's on the players." True and true. The Broncos are 1-4 in one possession games. The players deserve criticism, but this falls on the entire organization. The book on this team will be that if pounded bad teams, 6 of their 7 wins were by 10 or more points, but weren't good enough when punching up in class, save for Dallas. The other issue is their inability to win in the AFC West. Fangio is 5-12 in division games. When you lose a lot of division games, it doesn't help, and that's what we've done the last bunch of years, said kicker Brandon McManus, the last remaining player from the 2015 Super Bowl champions. It's not good when McManus represents the offensive highlight. His 61-yard field goal to close the first half was the longest of his career and the third longest in Broncos history. The first half goal-to-go issues returned in the second half when the Broncos were poised to stay in the game. But on fourth down from the Chargers' one, Melvin Gordon's touchdown was wiped out by an illegal formation penalty. McManus was good from 23 yards, and his ensuing kickoff was returned 101 yards by Andre Roberts for a touchdown to make it 27-6 Chargers. The addition of a 17th game only prolongs the misery for teams like the Broncos. We still have another game to play, Fangio said. Hopefully, we're going to have a normal week of practice and put our best foot forward, compete, and try to win that game. Broncos country refused to attend final home game of this lousy NFL team by Mark Kisla. You go ahead and pray for quarterback Aaron Rodgers, billionaire Jeff Bezos, and the ghost of Vince Lombardi to walk through the door of Broncos headquarters and rescue a no-account, good-for-nothing football team so annoying it left safety Justin Simmons begging for sweet mercy after being eliminated from the NFL playoffs for a sixth consecutive year. It's not having enough talent by any stretch of the imagination. Everybody in this league is talented, Simmons said Sunday after a COVID-depleted and dangerously clueless Broncos team was routed 34-13 by the Los Angeles Chargers. There's a certain barrier that I've noticed that we just haven't gotten over. When it comes down to it, you've got to find ways to win the close games. When you don't win the close games, that's when things start getting out of hand. Between heavy sighs, even frustrated words of Simmons sounded like a plea for help. So I say it's time for the good people of Broncos country to rise up and demand better from a franchise that has done wrong to America's most loyal sports fans for far too long. We all know the biggest barrier between this team and victory. It's coaching. Don't let the Broncos break your heart again until Vic Fangio is fired and new ownership shows commitment to bringing playoff football back to Colorado. There's only one real way to send a message to lame duck president Joe Ellis that paying customers will no longer hold their noses and put up with the stink Denver has thrown on the field since Super Bowl 50, expecting gullible fans to cheer, then drown their sorrow in overpriced beer. If you have tickets to the final home game of another lost season, do not use them. Sell them to the faithful followers of the Kansas City Chiefs, or dump them in protest in the trash. Take the tickets to the Ring of Fame Plaza at the north end of Empower Field and shred them as a sacrifice to the bust of the late, great Floyd Little to demonstrate this no-account mediocrity will no longer be tolerated. For decades, when no shows at home games have been announced, the absent fans were lustily booed. But on the final Saturday of this sad season, paying customers who stay away in protest should be applauded. How many no-shows will it take to drive home the message? 10,000? 20,000? More? Yes, I'm asking a big commitment from hardworking people who have already invested so much financially and emotionally in a team that has flopped in three consecutive games since taking a 7-6 record into the stretch run for an elusive playoff berth. So allow me to salute the stance taken by Frisco resident Chase Beck, a Colorado native who bleeds orange and screams for victory until he's blue in the face. Season tickets to the Broncos have been considered a family treasure since 1992. He currently owns two seats in the third deck of the north end zone because that's where the diehards reside. If he wanted a comfortable 50-yard view, Beck could do it from the comfort of his sofa at home. Way back in November, when the Beck family gathered for Thanksgiving, they carved the bird and came up with a plan of action. If the Broncos didn't fire Fangio by week 18 this season, they would refuse to attend the final home game against the hated Chiefs. I'm not selling my tickets. Just going to leave him empty. It's the strongest form of protest we have, Beck told me Sunday when I found him on social media, venting about a team that keeps inventing ways to scar his soul. How vexing can one NFL team possibly be? Offensive coordinator Pat Shurmur, who should have been given his walking papers weeks ago, showed how stuck in the past he is by dialing up a trick play near the goal line when Denver trailing 10-0 in the second quarter. On fourth down, Shurmur locked in a call requiring two handoffs and a pass from receiver Kendall Hinton to quarterback Drew Locke. You might know the play as the Philly Special. It worked in the Super Bowl nearly 4 years ago. It went bust with an ugly splat, Locke being tackled a yard short of the goal line on this first Sunday of 2022. Uncle Vic is the Washington Generals of NFL challenges. Whenever Fangio questions a call, the Zebras snicker behind his back. With more wishful thinking than clear-eyed logic, he challenged a 40-yard reception by Austin Eckler in the third quarter, claiming the running back touched his knee to the turf while dodging a tackle by Simmons. Well, we know how that turned out. I have a better chance of hitching a free ride on a rocket to outer space with Bezos than Uncle Vic has of seeing one of his challenge prayers answered. In the NFL, the only thing that matters is the playoffs. Yeah, it's disappointing. You can do really good things throughout the year, but your main goal is to make the playoffs. We didn't do what we wanted to do this year, said Locke, who passed for 245 yards and did not throw an interception in 25 attempts. My number one goal is to win the football game. Taking care of the ball and not winning the game in a quarter will get you a donut. We dream of Rodgers leaving Green Bay and coming to the rescue in the Rocky Mountains. But if Rodgers takes a long, hard look at this mess in Denver, I'm afraid that frozen tundra will start looking like football heaven. This horse hockey the Broncos roll out on the field is an embarrassment to the legacy of the late Pat Bowlen. Demand better, Broncos country. Demand change. Avs win in return from lengthy COVID pause by Kyle Fredrickson. The Avalanche is back to its winning ways after more than 2 weeks without playing a game. Colorado rallied for a 4-2 victory Sunday at Ball Arena, overcoming a two-goal deficit that mirrored its sluggish start. Forward Logan O'Connor scored the game-winning goal with 71 seconds left in regulation. Colorado in action for the first time since December 16th due to COVID-19 pauses extended its home winning streak to 9 games. The Avalanche travels Tuesday to face Chicago. Scoring didn't come easy for us tonight, coach Jared Bednar said. I love the stick-to-itiveness to our group to just kind of keep at it and keep at it, dig out of the hole and eventually get the win. On Sunday, the Ducks flew ahead early with a rebound goal via forward Sam Carrick past Avalanche goalie Darcy Kemper, just 1:55 into the game. It sucked the energy from a Ball Arena crowd. Anaheim went up 2-0 in the second period on a power play chance. The Avs were 16 seconds away from earning a kill when Ducks defenseman Cam Fowler redirected the puck and beat Kemper. First period, we didn't execute really well, Bednar said. There were a few poor decisions, but then also just mis-execution. We turned the puck over a little bit, and they were coming back on us. That's when Colorado flipped the script. The next Avalanche power play opportunity resulted in a Devon Taves snipe, fed by Mikko Rantanen and Nazem Kadri to make it 2-1, closing the second period. Taves has 5 goals this season. Ducks goalie John Gibson was phenomenal with a number of impressive saves, but Avalanche captain Gabe Landeskog tied the game less than 4 minutes into the third period with a power play goal. Then O'Connor put Colorado ahead for good on a breakaway, assisted by Nathan MacKinnon. Rantanen added an open net goal to close it out. Gibson is a big body and uses those angles well, O'Connor said. You've got to get traffic in front. We had a bunch of net battles there that we could have capitalized on. You just got to try and elevate the puck. A 16-day gap in between games allowed the Avalanche to regain nearly full roster health upon return play. Colorado has only four players on its injury report: McDonald, Stefan Matto, Ryan Murray, and Valanichushkin. The team is fully removed from the NHL's health and safety protocol list for COVID-19. Avs defenseman Bo Byram returned to the ice Sunday for the first time since December 1st after the 20-year-old rookie dealt with a series of concussion-related injuries. Byram finished with 18:35 in ice time and no points. As the game went on, Byram got more involved. No major errors on his part, Bednar said. He managed the puck pretty well. It was a pretty simple game from what we've seen from him. That's to be expected with the time that he's missed. I think that will come back to him here quickly, especially getting into some games now. And thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.